Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comment. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter, and that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events. Welcome, 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 everyone. We have a lot to cover today. We're going to talk a little bit about George Zimmerman's $200,000 PayPal account. Yep, that's right. When he testified, he actually said, or the family said, they didn't have any money. But it turns out the judge found out that through the attorney that he had actually had $200,000 in a PayPal account. We also look at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and we take a look at President Obama's slow jam in the news. And is there truly a war on women? And a lot more. So let's get started. First up, I want to talk a little bit about the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Now, I think the New York Times article said it best. They said that President Obama poked fun at himself, Congress, the Secret Service, the media, and particularly his rival Mitt Romney on Saturday night, mocking his Republican opponent as a fuddy-duddy rich guy who travels with his dog in a cage strapped to the roof of the family car. Delivering the traditional comment remarks at the annual White House Correspondents Association dinner, the president seemed to enjoy needling Mr. Romney just days after the general election contest effectively got underway. The highlight was a spoof Romney ad showing the former governor at the door of Air Force One with a dog cage on top of the aircraft. Now, families are off limit, Mr. Obama declared, but dogs, however, are apparently fair game. Mr. Obama pointed out that he was speaking in a carnivorous hotel ballroom, or what Mitt Romney would call a little fixer-upper. He noted that he and Mr. Romney both had degrees from Harvard University, but the Republican, Mitt Romney, that is, has two. And Mr. Obama said, "What a snob." Of course, Mr. Obama joked, and he said after his own appearance on Jim Fallon's show this week, Mr. Romney asked if he could get some equal time on the Merv Griffin show. You know, I thought the president was pretty funny, even at the beginning when he did the skit, as if he was talking about the audience and why he's even there, and he even poked fun at Kim Kardashian, what I thought was really hilarious. And speaking of funny, President Obama was also on the Jimmy Fallon show this week, and he did a segment called Slow Jamming the News. Now, of course, President Obama has been, making these appearances over the last week talking about the student loan crisis that we're in and about them changing the interest rates, them allowing them to double. So I want you to take a listen at President Obama's rendition of, and Jimmy Fallon's rendition of Slow Jamming the News. Take a listen.
You might have seen this in the news, but President Obama has asked Congress to stop the interest rates on Stafford student loans from going up this summer. I was going to make a joke about this news, but I don't think it needs a joke. You know what I'm talking about, Tariq?
Yeah, Jimmy, I think you're saying you want to slow jam this news.
That's right. I want to slow jam the news, and I'm not the only one. I'm President Barack Obama, and I, too, want to slow jam the news. On July 1st of this year, the interest rates on Stafford student loans, the same loans that many of you use to help pay for college, are set to double. That means some hardworking students will be paying about $1,000 extra just to get their education. So I've called on Congress to prevent this from happening. What we said is simple. Now is not the time to make school more expensive for our young people.
Oh, yeah. You should listen to the president. Or as I like to call him, the Preezy of the United Steezy. Things are heating up inside Congress's chambers behind all those closed doors. So the president made a few discreet calls across the aisle. He said, hey, let's get together on this one. Without an affordable Stafford loan, where can a student turn? The Pell Grant is a beautiful thing, but with college getting more expensive, is it enough by itself to satisfy all your collegiate needs? Oh, Pell no. If Congress doesn't act, it's the students who play. The right and left should join on this like Kim and Kanye.
Now, there's some in Congress who disagree. They say keeping the interest rate low isn't the way to help our students. They say we should be doing everything we can to pay down the national debt. Well, so long as it doesn't include taxing billionaires. But their position is that students just have to make this rate increase work. Frankly, I don't buy it.
The Barackness monster ain't buying it. We all know our legislative bodies in the House tossing and turning late into the night, but still Republicans disagree and could even filibuster. But if they do, the president said they're gonna feel it, Buster.
The GOP is steady saying no, no, no. They should find something new to do like Tim Tebow.
The reason it's so important to keep down costs is so we keep college affordable.
And the president knows his stuff, y'all. That's why they call him the POTUS, which means person on top. What is it?
Jimmy, POTUS stands for President of the United States.
He's the POTUS with the
slow jam the news.
Oh, yeah.
Give it up for President Barack Obama.
Now, of course, a lot of people made light of this, even Mitt Romney. But the reality is, you know, it was a pretty effective piece that he did. You know, he's reaching out to young people and the people that it affects the most. He's doing it in a kind of a way that really can reach them. You know, in many cases, you know, a lot of young people are not watching C-SPAN or not watching a whole lot of television, but they are watching these shows like Jimmy Fallon, the Colbert Report, John Stewart. So they're watching these shows. He's reaching out, trying to get them because he know if and it's been effective, I might add too. And if you haven't heard what's happening here and why he's reaching out to young voters, let me kind of remind you that the House of Representatives advanced a bill Friday that funds cheaper student loans by cutting a preventive health care program. So there was a lot going on with President Obama saying, hey, on July 1st, these student loans are going to go up. The interest rates are going to go up. And he's asking a lot of the young people to reach out to him and to make sure that the Congress people don't allow this to happen. And so what they did was they went out and they tried to pass a health care. I mean, they tried to go ahead and pass this bill because they did get a lot of feedback from a lot of young people. But what they try to do, well, they try to stuff it in with trying to usurp the law with actually cutting back on benefits for women. And so I mentioned earlier about there potentially being a war on women. And so I'm going to kind of later on in the program kind of outline why I think that's the case. But in this particular instance, what the president has said to kind of keep the interest rate low, the House passed a bill with 30 Republicans bucking the party to oppose the bill and 13 Democrats voting in favor of the bill. But it was trying to the interest rates for federally subsidized student loans is scheduled to jump from 3.4% to 6.8%. Let me say that again. The interest rate for federally subsidized student loans is scheduled to jump 3.4% to 6.8%. That's doubled. From some 7.4 million students. And this is going to happen on July 1st. Now, Republicans have voted early in the week for a budget that allowed the rate to go up. But because of the public pressure, offered a plan Wednesday to preserve the rate by cutting the prevention and public health fund created in President Obama's Affordable Care Act. So, in essence, they're saying, okay, we hear you, American people. We know you don't want the rate, but let's get in. Let's try to, you know, let's try to fund this by using by putting this on the back of the Prevention and Public Health Fund created in the Affordable Care Act. So I posed the question, you know, early on: is this truly a war on women? I really want you to weigh on in, and I also want you to weigh in on the fact that what do you think about these student loans doubling? From 3.4% to 6.8%. All these questions, after the break, when we return, I want you to address. The number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. When we return, we'll take your calls. Be back in a moment.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Gina, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my East Boone friend.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Patrick Cook.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. In just a few minutes, we're going to open up the phone lines. But before we do that, joining me live in the studio is the executive producer of Current Events and Chief Operating Officer of TaylorMade Training and Consulting. I introduce to some and present to others, Jima Hill Cook. Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, before we get started with the student loan, because I think that's very important that we cover this in excruciating detail, because we got a few comments already out there on Facebook that talks about that, so we're going to get right to them in just a minute. But first, I want to know about the White House correspondence. Did you enjoy it?
I did. I thought it was hilarious. I think, the president is in a zone sometimes when he's up there at that correspondence dinner because he can kind of say whatever and get away with it. I mean, you know, there's always a line. But I thought he did well. He had some funny ones, you know. I think he kind of took the stuff for me, taking the sting out of the whole dog eating thing, because he had several references to dogs and eating them. So I think the fact that he said it so often now kind of negates the need for, you know, the Republicans to try to use it as some sort of wedge or some sort of main issue, because he's kind of taking the fire out of it, I think. But I thought overall it was good. I think, you know, I thought Jimmy Kimmel ran a little long, but he was funny, but I just thought he ran, you know, he probably did one or two jokes too many.
What was your favorite moment? I guess I should say, what was your favorite joke that the president did?
Oh, man, seriously? I don't know.
Well, I thought it was funny for him to poke with two things he did. I thought was kind of edgy, if you will. The fact that he poked fun at the Huffington Post for their way in which they present the news, because we all know that they're what they call an aggregation news source, right? Just like Current Events with Patrick Cook, our blog site is similar to the Huffington Post, but we just have a specific concentrated, and we have a unique perspective on what we present, but it's in essence the same thing that the Huffington Post does. And so
right.
I thought it was funny for him to say that, you know, that he congratulated Arianna Huffington for the Pulitzer Prize that they won, but he also said, he kind of took a dig at him by saying that them linking to heavy-hitting journalism. I thought that was hilarious. And then the second thing, when he was doing during the skit, he asked, why was Kim Kardashian famous anyway, I thought was another dig. So I thought those two were truly funny because, I mean, we kind of say those things in a, you know, in a behind-the-scenes fashion, but for him to say it publicly like that, I thought was funny.
Yeah, and I think the one where he made reference lightly to the Secret Service and having to go in early since they got a new curfew, I thought that was funny. So, yeah, he had some good ones in there. He did. And then the whole facial expression of who he said he listened to when he said something about is it Young Jeezy? You know, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it was Jeezy. It was Jeezy, yeah, yeah.
And then I thought that was funny because isn't that who Eric Cantor said he listens to? That's why I think he said that. Because Cantor earlier this week or latter part of last week made reference to Lil Jeezy, and everybody was like, seriously? So I think, you know, that was kind of like a dig at Eric Cantor, too. And then Michelle, her face was like, yeah, you know, like she was into that particular when he said, you know, he sings that to her sometimes. So I thought that was funny. And she
looked
gorgeous.
Speaking of Michelle, oh, my Lord, she was just immaculate.
Yeah,
she
looked gorgeous.
She's just so beautiful. So what do you make of her maturation through the years? You know, obviously, she's a very eloquent, very smart and intelligent, well-spoken, mannerable. I mean, all of those things. But I can say that I've seen a level of maturity of her over the past several years, just being in that type of environment and taking all those digs from all these people. It doesn't seem like it bothers her at all now.
Well, when you know what you know, and you, when you know who you belong to, then you can take all of what the arrows that come your way, and they don't bother you. I mean, you know, they bother you as a human, but they don't bother you as it relates to what your purpose is. And so when you know what you've been called to do, what you've been appointed and anointed to do, when you know you are in a particular space and time for a reason, then you do what it is you know you've been called to do. Because if you trust where you are and you know you're supposed to be there, then it doesn't matter what the people say. It doesn't matter the attacks that come at you. You just keep going. And eventually either they'll get on board or they won't. And but your job is not even to convince them to get on board. Your job is to do what you've been called to do. And I think Michelle has shown that, and even the president. But I think Michelle has shown that in such a way that where you have the highest level of expectation, because he is the president, Michelle has even raised the bar as it relates to that position as well. She's more popular than the president. She has a higher favorability rating than the president. People want to see her everywhere. And so I think because she's allowed, she did not allow the distractors to define who she was, she knew who she was, and she knew what she was called to do, and she's walking in that. And so for that, she's an example to us all. When you know you've been called to do something, and, you know, although you get to that job and everybody's trying to figure out how you got there, who did you know, did they lower the standards? Because, you know, a lot of times when we show up places and positions, something else had to happen for us to get there. We don't just get there based solely on our record, based solely on what we've accomplished. It's always something extra. But when we know what we've done and we know I'm here because this is where I'm supposed to be, then all that other stuff doesn't get in the way.
And so when I look at her, I see all of that you just said. I mean, I really truly see the genuine lady that exudes, you know, the First Lady of the United States of America. And so she's done an amazing job in holding up that office and setting the bar higher for all first ladies to come. I mean, it's going to be very hard for another first couple to come into the White House and have the impact that these two have had on the American people as a whole. Because before now, I can say from experience, I really didn't feel a connection to the first family. I felt like as it was, you know, was it just a different tier altogether. Now I have a higher amount of respect and admiration for the office, but I now truly feel as if it's really a truly extension of my family. And so in that line of thinking, I just think that the president and the first family has truly is now part of the American family in all that they do. And I think Michelle does a job of it really setting an example.
And I think what they do is that they're in places where, and you see them in places that you frequent. By that I mean, you alluded to this earlier, you know, I'm not sitting up watching C-SPAN all day. I'm really not. And so that's where in the past you would see some of our political figures just hanging out on C-SPAN. Or very seldom would you see them doing things that we would quote-unquote call normal. And so when you see the president and the first lady, you know, on The View or on Ellen DeGeneres or on Jimmy Fallon, you know, wherever you see them at, you know, that you're watching that, you know. So you, there's so many ways to get a message out that it's not just on some Sunday morning talk show. It's not just on the quote-unquote serious political shows that come on or the political newspapers and all of that. There's so many places that they've shown up and been a part of that everyday regular people see them. And I think that's why the connection is so strong, because they're in the publications that we do read. They're on the shows that we do watch, even television shows, you know, that we do watch. So I think that has a lot to do with it as well.
You mentioned he was on Jimmy Fallon this week, and I kind of played a little clip of it earlier. What do you think about his appearance on that? Was it effective?
You know, in my opinion, anything the president does is effective, because he is probably the greatest strategist ever. I don't think he does anything by happenstance. Even what appears to be something insignificant at some point will have a pretty big role to play. And so I think it was a great idea. The naysayers are not the ones that watch Jimmy Fallon anyway, so, you know, we're not looking for them to be a big Jimmy Fallon fan. But those that watch Jimmy Fallon was happy that he was on there. It gave them something to sit up and talk about. And so he accomplished what he wanted to accomplish. He talked about those things that were serious, but he also, you know, had a little fun with the show. And that's what you do when you go on those shows. You let people see you another way.
Right. And so his main message this week was about student interest rate. And this is where I want to kind of take a shift to, a turn towards. And, in fact, on the 24th and 25th of last week of this month, President Obama traveled to North Carolina, Colorado, University of Colorado, in fact, and Iowa to launch an effort to get Congress to prevent interest rates on student loans from doubling in July. Again, I talked about more than 7.4 million students with federal student loans will see their interest rates double on July 1st unless Congress steps in to keep them low. For each year Congress allows the rates to double, the average student with these loans rack up an additional $1,000 in debt. At a time when Americans owe more on student loans than credit cards, President Obama believes we must reward hard work and responsibility by keeping interest rates low on student loans. So I want to ask the question first, Jima, is this outrageous for the student loans to be going up so rapidly and so fast?
Well, yes, it's out of control. But I think when you look at, you know, the bigger picture, and here's where, you know, as they say, the devil is in the details, because I think if we were to rein in the cost of a college education, then you would be able to rein in the amount of loans that students have to take out in order to obtain that college degree. So I think the back door is, okay, let's make sure the rates don't go up, but, you know, the next step of that, you know, that's just phase one. Phase two is, what is it that's causing college tuition and fees to go up so high anyway? I can't seem to understand what it is that's happening on college campuses today. And I know I've been out of college undergrad since the 90s. Be quiet. Thank you very much. But I'm, you know, what's changed in on the college campus that there's something there now that wasn't there when I was there. And I know technology and all that. I get that, but I don't think all of the increases has to do with maintaining certain technologies on campus. And I think somebody needs to investigate that. You know, as it relates to state schools, for sure, because I know back in the day, if, you know, you lived in Kansas, which is where I was raised, if you lived in Kansas, you were going to get into just Kansas, University of Kansas or Kansas State or any other school in the state of Kansas, public school. And so what happened to that? You know, you were guaranteed admission. It wasn't going to cost you as much. I mean, the greater your GPA, then the greater aid you got, and that aid wasn't loans. It was grants, Pell grants. It was work scholarships that work study that you got that helped offset that. So, you know, when did that money dry up, and where did it go? And I think once we, ask those questions and then receive some good answers to those questions and not just the baloney that they're used to feeding us, then we can really tackle student loan debt. But until we do that, this is just a Band-Aid, excuse me, although it's much needed. Don't misunderstand me. I do not want rates to go up by any stretch of the imagination. But the real issue is, what is driving the increase in the cost of education? That's the real issue.
You know, along those same lines, I have to mention a comment that my colleague, Mrs. Ward, said on Facebook. And which was interesting. I hadn't thought about this until she mentioned it. But she said, how in the heck are we supposed to encourage kids to go to school and they keep increasing the student loans? You know, at some point, there's a point of what we say in engineering, a point of diminishing returns. You can pay so much, whereas you won't get the return on your investment anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, if I go to college and get a degree in anthropology, and I end up spending $100,000 for my college education, how long would it take me to pay back that $100,000 at those interest rates? Because it's pretty much a mortgage by the time I get out of college. So
right.
I have to echo her words. How in the heck are we supposed to encourage kids to go to school and they keep increasing the student loans? You say what, Jim?
Well, it's two things I say to that. The realist of me says, you know, we can't make the assumption that every loan every student take out is really to go to college. Because we know sometimes you borrow more than what you need to pay your tuition, so you can do other stuff with that. So that's the other part of it. We have to begin to teach people to be responsible when they're taking out these student loans. So, you know, I agree with that. We do have to do that. But I agree with the fact that we have to do a better job of preparing our students for college as well. I've never, and we've talked about this so many times, it's unreal, but I've never seen so many kids graduating from high school that are not prepared to go to college. And so they spend the next 2 years getting ready for college, taking remedial classes that they're paying for, mind you. Those classes aren't free. So you're paying for some classes to get you ready for college that you should have been getting ready for it in high school. So now you've graduated. You're not really academically ready. So you go to, let's say you go to a junior college or a community college first. That's not free either. It may not cost as much as a four-year, but none of this is not going to cost you something. And so, you know, let's peel back another layer and take a look at the other issue of the amount of kids coming out that are not prepared for college, because that's a waste of money as well.
You know, there's a reality is in the chat room. He's saying it's all about supply and demand. Many people attend college, some finish and some do not. Majority have student loans. Those loans are not being paid. Therefore, an increase would help balance this situation. So it seems like Mr. Reality's is suggesting that it's because we've incurred so much debt in student loans, they're raising the price to kind of make up for some of the people that are not really paying those loans back. What do you think about that?
Well, but here's the thing, though. I mean, yeah, I know people that have waited until they couldn't wait anymore to pay their student loan, to be even begin to start to pay their student loan back. I do know those people. And so, I don't know how big of an impact that has on, I mean, I think that's a small piece of the pie. I still say the increase in the cost of tuition, which is then causing you to borrow more because tuition has increased so much. So I think it's not a either or. I think it's an and. I think all of those things are part of the problem.
Okay, so when it comes to student loans, I'm a culprit too. I mean, I had to borrow money for my undergraduate and graduate degree in computer science. And when I first got my student loans, and here's where the education piece people need to understand too, is when I first got my student loans. Of course, through college, I didn't have to pay any of them back until when I graduated. Then I didn't make a lot of money first getting out of college, so I wasn't able to, you know, afford a house, pay my car, pay basic bills and my student loans because they were so high. So I deferred them, thinking that I eventually make enough money to pay them back in a reasonable amount of time. But it turns out, by me waiting without paying any interest or not paying anything on the principal at all, then it turns out when I was in a position to pay the amount, the rate has increased four or five times what the initial amount was. So we talked about the whole student loan process and getting, you know, and going through the process of getting student loan. But kids, especially that doesn't have that pedigree of, you know, people going to college, need to understand the whole process of how student loans work as well. So I know there's an increasing amount of debt, but we also need to be educated or how to manage that debt when we get out of college.
Right. And I think it's also incumbent, I mean, that, you know, that was the other piece I was speaking about. You take out really what you need and not to pay all, you know, not to finance your trip for spring break in the spring, you know. You take out what you need to make it through college, not all the other stuff. And I think sometimes, you know, we take out more than what's absolutely necessary because it's not an immediate it doesn't have an immediate impact on us. We're not losing anything right away. And you're right, there's so many things that happen. And then you got to remember, I think, you know, when you look back, people, you know, my age that came out in the 90s and my undergraduate and what, you know, the amount of loans, you know, we took out then. And I went to school out of state. And so you always have the out-of-state tuition is higher than in-state tuition. And so, you know that going in. I recognize that. However, you know, I would be disingenuous if I didn't say took out a little extra because I was living off campus, so I wanted to go ahead and pay my rent up for my first semester. So that's what I'm talking about. You know, did I borrow more than what I needed to get my education? The bottom line to that is yes, I did. Now,
well, I would argue though that all of that is a part of your education, though. Going down to get my PhD in engineering at the Texas Tech University, and when I'm looking at all of the money to go to school, especially for a PhD, then we're talking about the fact that it's not just tuition. There's living expenses. You have to eat. You have to live. So I understand your position about taking out what you need, but we also know that going to college is not just about paying tuition.
Right. Right, there's a whole lot to go with that, but once I moved off campus and decided I wanted an apartment, then I should have been thinking about a job, and I did. I mean, it's not like I didn't work in college. I did work in college, but I'm just saying I know people who didn't work, who took out the maximum they could take out, and that's what they lived off of each semester. I know that for sure. I know that for a fact. And it had nothing, you know, all their tuition was paid, their fees, they got their books, you know, they did everything, all of that, and then they had this other lump sum just sitting on that they just used throughout the course of the semester. That's what they lived off of, you know. And so that's fine, but as you stated, when you get out of school and you have those 6-month grace period and you're looking for a job in those 6 months, because, you know, that's what they give you. And then my time was dealing with Sallie Mae, who, after years of investigating, we find out was just, the biggest scam known to man. And so how many of us fell into that trap? And then the whole point of being able to consolidate all of those loans into one, because like you, when I went back and got my master's, I had to take out a little bit as well. And so you add that up with your undergrad, and you add that up with what you do if you decide to get a second degree, and you're looking at a pretty penny. And then if you're not paying on that over the course of time, it's almost going to be like you took out $100,000 when initially you started with 50.
Right.
You know, and it gets, and it grows. I mean, it just grows. You're like, well, you go from $100-some payment to $500. That's a car payment.
No doubt about that. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Press 1 to talk and 2 to listen. I also want to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about something I call not starting at zero. And what I mean by that is, since we know that this has been occurring for many, many years, Jima talked about she went to undergraduate in the 60s. I mean, correction, in the 90s. and so now here we are in 2012, and we've had a generation has passed us, right? And so we need to take this knowledge and tell our young people two things. One, you know, really learn how to manage your student loans. And then two, as parents, as grandparents, we need to be starting preparing our kids to go to college today. I mean, even if you can save, you know, $10, $15 a week or $100 a month for that child's education from K through 12, when they get to college years, when they get to be the college age, then they will be in a good position to go to college. Now, we know that college has been increasing year in and year out for the last couple of decades, but what I'm suggesting is only this. You know, if a kid goes to college and he can start from something other than zero, he's going to be in a better position when he graduates from college. Because all the things we talked about, living expenses, food, going out, and having a social life, because you need balance in college. Then you can go out and borrow just the money for tuition, because you've accumulated enough money over the years so that kid would not have to start out in the negative, right? He can at least start from zero. It would be better if they start out in the positive by having some money after college, but at least give the child an opportunity by preparing them for college now. And if they don't use the money for college for whatever reason, they can use it for their first home. Or their first, you know, to move to another country, anything they wanted to do, but they would not be starting in the negative. So
right,
go ahead.
And I think what we have to do, you know, when we hear save, you know, people, I don't have no money to save, I can't save, but for that $5 you spend on that cup of coffee, you know, every day, you could save that $5, and that's your savings. I mean, you know, there's so many, you know, ways in which we could manage it a lot better than what we do. And if you go out to lunch every day, or if you go, even if you go out to lunch once a week, whatever you're spending extra outside of, you know, taking care of your household expenses, that's your savings right there. And I don't think we talk about that enough, because we, you know, we don't want anybody to feel like they're being deprived. But at the end of the day, you know, those sacrifices is not a bad word. It really isn't. And then when you talk about researching and finding scholarships and different grants that are out there, even the children of Israel, when they was hungry, they had to say they was hungry. They had to call out and tell the Lord, "We hungry," for the manna to fall down from heaven. So you still have to do something. Even if you're the most destitute, you know, find a way to the library and look through those journals there, or try to get online at the library. Well, you know, people talk about what they don't have at home, but the libraries, until, you know, something happens, they're still available, and they still have access to the Internet, and it's still free. So, you know, there's so many ways we can do it, and most libraries are on a bus route somewhere. So it can't be, I don't have a car. I'm trying to help with the excuses that we come up with as to why we don't go out and research. And so go to the libraries and begin to research what kind of scholarships and those sorts of things that are available. And as you stated, we can begin now. I mean, you know, we've done a lot of things to prepare for our son, who's five, to go to college, not just college, but to go to Harvard. You know, we're, you know, that that's a, you know, that we expect that to happen, and not, and we're just not going to will that into existence. We got to put some work behind that.
That's right.
You know,
right.
We got to prepare him educationally, so we have to make sure that foundation is set. But then we got to make sure we're putting some things aside as well. And so, you know, how do you do that? You know, when with the one income home, and you got all the things you have to do, you sacrifice. And so I think we have to do a better job of recognizing that we can sacrifice and that we can contribute to our children's education by doing more than just saying, oh, you know, I can't afford it, or my child can't afford to go to school. You and I have heard that so many times over the years from parents saying what they can't afford to do with their child as it relates to sending them to college. And some of the avenues that we've introduced them to were things they had never thought about.
Absolutely. 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. We're going to go to the phone lines. We're going to go to caller last 4-3732. You're on Current Events with Patrick Cook. Give us your name and where you're calling from.
Hello, this is Mr. Motivator in Dallas.
Hey, Mr. Motivator. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. How are you guys doing today?
Absolutely wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited to hear you talk about college tuition and educational expenses. This is a burden on a lot of families. And I look back at the time when I attended college. I was on college work study program, and a lot of other things going on. But I was fortunate, blessed to receive a scholarship for having the highest grade point average in economics. And so my scholarship paid for my college education. So when I graduated from college, I graduated debt-free. And you mentioned a good point, and I maybe you could cover that some more, but I think, especially here in Texas, the kids are taught to focus more on taking a test and being successful and on a test in order to get in college, as opposed to learning about college, how to survive college, how to handle the expense of the college fees that they will accumulate while they're in college. And maybe you could elaborate, and do you think that the schools have a responsibility to focus more on the whole issue of college as opposed to just talking to the kids about a test only? Do you think the schools could do a better job of that? And also, do you think the colleges should play a part in educating the student about debt and their expenses and not abusing the loan while they're in school?
Okay, so I'm going to let Jima respond too as well, but I'm going to first chime in with, I'm going to say yes, yes, and all of the above, because I believe that all those things are necessary for a successful college entrance, right, and exit. Because in my specific case, when I was in high school, you know, my mom could not afford to send me to college, right? She didn't have the financial means to do that. But that's just only one part, right? I mean, there's another part where you're talking about scholarship, your education, your GPA. Those things allow you another opportunity to go to college. So it's not just about going to college, getting in college financially. You've got to be academically prepared. And so when you mention the thing about the test, well, the school who focuses on having the kids be successful in the test, not because it benefits the student, because it does, but because it benefits the school. The high school that's proctoring the test or administering the test, mainly because it's a part of their academic performance where they can go out and get more funding, they can go out and market their schools and things of that nature. And so it's not just for the kids. Now, there are programs out there all over the country that are allowing or teaching young, well, we even had one, Etiquette, Science, and Politics, you know, over a decade ago, where we actually went out and talked about several things. We talked about one being academically prepared. That means making the grade, taking the SATs early and often so you can get the highest score and you can get the highest probability of getting the best education. We also talked about scholarships. We talked about setting a plan where you can actually go out and from sophomore to junior year where you start making a preparation. It's too late to be doing it as a senior. I mean, a lot of people go out and say, I'm in the 12th grade, I'm going to college in the spring, and now I'm going to start. I'm telling you that's too late. I'm not going to say don't do it at that time, but I'm saying the best time to be prepared for college is first grade, kindergarten, academically. And then when you get into the ninth grade, you need to start taking the SATs, SATs, start taking them in the 10th grade so you can, you know, have a higher score you can possibly so you can get into to a great school. And then scholarships. Plan out to do a scholarship every opportunity you get. Go out there and look them up. Go out there and put together a portfolio. Give your reasons. Build your program. There's a lot of preparations you can do to get in college outside of just worrying about financial aid and as well as student loans. Jima?
I agree with everything you said. I mean, I think it's important that, you know, the school has a responsibility to a point, but as parents, we have a responsibility as well. As the community, we have a responsibility as well. As a house of faith, whatever that is that you go, they have a responsibility as well. And I think when we were, you know, one of the things that we identified this past summer in the summer reading and feeding program is that we identified, you know, at a certain age that young people were struggling that were in the first and second grade to count money and to add. And we were alarmed by that because it was such a high number of them. Well, you know, I don't know what they're teaching in school, but I know what you don't know, and I know you don't know how to count money. And that's something that you need to know how to do. So how can I help you with that when it comes to, you know, multiplication and things of that nature? You know, there's a lot out there available to parents that's free, and it doesn't cost anything for you to access it. And so although the school has to do what it has to do for its money and for the test to keep their schools functioning, you know, we still as parents have a part to play in making sure our kids are educated in the whole spectrum of what education means. And so when you get to that part of what the caller was referencing to about getting into college, then, you know, you have to stay in college. And, there, you know, you have to have practice good habits before you get to college. And you made a reference too, Patrick, in terms of you're not waiting until your senior year to decide, you know, that you want to start looking at scholarships, and definitely not waiting until January or February to fill out your financial aid packet, because a lot of schools give out the money early, and the later that you submit your application, the less likely you're going to get a large sum of money. And so all of those things are important, but the school system takes it so far, but as parents and as the community and all those people involved in that child's life, you know, the greatest responsibility is on us to make it happen. So,
yeah, and so, and I also want to add, for those of us that don't know, because I didn't know, and ask. There are people in the community, especially at church. You mentioned about House of Faith, that we go and frequent stores. We see people in our community. Some of them have been to college. Some of them know about the college. I mean, even your local NAACP chapter, your local Urban League. I mean, there are people that know, and so it's incumbent upon parents to go out and ask. Go out and get the information necessary and get the help that's required for them, for their children to be successful, because we don't want the next generation of kids starting out in the negative. It's time for another break, and when we return, we're going to take some more calls. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, Tailor Made Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club
or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I wanted to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my East Bloom.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Patrick Cook.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dick Uliano. A British Red Cross worker has been found dead in Quetta, Pakistan. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Islamabad that a note found on the decapitated body said the aid worker had been killed by the Taliban.
Little had been heard about Khalil Dale since armed men abducted him from the streets of Quetta in January. His work as the manager of the health program in Quetta would have put him at risk in a region that is home to separatist fighters and Islamist militants, including the Taliban, who conduct kidnappings for ransom. Police said the note pinned to Dale's body, which was discovered wrapped in a plastic bag, said he was killed because his ransom had not been paid. The International Red Cross condemned the murder of its staff doctor, calling Dale very experienced. He had also served in Somalia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Dale is the third Westerner to be killed in Pakistan in the past 10 years. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Islamabad.
The body of Libya's former oil minister, Shukri Ghanem, was found today in the Danube River in Vienna. Last year, Ghanem publicly split with Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi and backed the rebels who toppled the Gaddafi regime. Police say the cause of death is not immediately clear and it's under investigation. Ghanem is a former Libyan premier. Clashes are being reported in Egypt today. In Cairo, unidentified assailants used rocks and firebombs to attack protesters outside the Egyptian Defense Ministry. NPR's Soraya Sarhadi Nelson reports from Cairo. One protester was killed and dozens more wounded.
The protesters were supporters of hardline cleric Hazem Abu Ismail. Election officials recently banned him from running for president because his late mother held both American and Egyptian citizenship in violation of the eligibility rules. The cleric has said his mother only had a green card. His supporters have staged many demonstrations on his behalf. Protesters here are frequently attacked by unidentified assailants, especially outside of the defense or interior ministries. Many activists blame the attacks on thugs hired by security forces. The military junta has also tried to discredit protesters by accusing them of being hooligans under the influence of foreign powers, particularly the United States. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
The head of the UN observer mission in Syria is urging the government and the opposition to stop fighting and give the ceasefire a chance. Major General Robert Moods was speaking upon his arrival in Syria, where he's in charge of a team of UN monitors trying to save the international plan to end Syria's 16-month-old conflict. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has added his voice to other Israeli officials against a military strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Olmert said today, "There is no reason at this time not to talk about a military effort, but definitely not to initiate one." You're listening to NPR News. Sudan has declared a state of emergency in some areas of its disputed border with South Sudan. From the South's capital, Juba, NPR's Ophabia Quist-Arkton reports, the announcement comes as South Sudan announces its commitment to stop all fighting with its northern neighbor and quit the contested frontier zone.
These conflicting developments in the two Sudans raise more questions about whether various appeals will avert out-and-out war and end border clashes. The UN has called on both sides to withdraw their troops and police from contested regions along the oil-rich 1,100-mile frontier. South Sudan says it has told the UN it will pull back its police from Abyei, a disputed region whose status has yet to be decided. The conflict between the Sudans is destabilizing their already weak, oil-dependent economies that cannot afford the expense of renewed war. Ophabia Quist-Arkton, NPR News, Juba.
A Sunday afternoon accident in New York City near the Bronx Zoo has claimed 7 lives. Police say a van plunged off the Bronx River Parkway and plunged more than 50 feet. It's not clear what caused the crash. The 7 dead include an 84-year-old man, 3 women, and 3 girls, ages 12, 10, and 7. The Coast Guard has found the wreckage of a yacht and 3 bodies. A 4th crew member is still missing. The Aegean disappeared early Saturday during a race from Newport Beach, California, to Ensenada, Mexico. Race officials say it appears the boat collided with a much larger vessel. The race goes through shipping lanes, and officials say it's possible a freighter could have hit it. I'm Dick Iuliano, NPR News in Washington.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. For the past first segment of the show, we kind of talked mostly, mainly about the student loan issue. But I wanted to shift now to what the Republicans did in response to what was happening about the student loans. Now, they had voted earlier in the week for a budget that allowed the rate to go up. But because of President Obama's going out to Colorado, UNC, and Iowa, and all the pressure that has been applied to the office, the Congress, then they offered a plan to Wednesday to preserve the rate by cutting the prevention and public health fund created by President Obama's Affordable Care Act. Now, calling the health program, which aims to lower health care costs by encouraging prevention, a slush fund, this is what they say, a slush fund, Boehner said its funding should be used to help students instead. So they want to shift the dollars associated with funding cancer screenings, child immunizations, and programs designed to help people quit smoking and eating right. They want to shift those funds to fund what they're talking about as far as the saving the interest rate on student loans. So the Democrats are saying this is a war on women. They continue to use that language. So I want to pose the question, especially since they're now taking another stab at women with respect to saying, okay, we'll save the interest rate, but let's take the money out of these things that are associated with women and then put them over there. Is this truly a war on women? So, Jima, I want to pose that question to you. Do you think this is a war on women?
Well, yes. I mean, I think whatever term they want to call it, whether it's a war, an attack, total disregard, all of those words would fit fine in my world, because there's no way you can say, on the one hand, in terms of college, you want to not raise the rates in terms of the tuition and the rates of the loans, and then on the other hand, you say, yeah, but we're going to take our funding that's used to help women as it relates to mammograms and testing for cervical cancer and of those things. That just doesn't make sense. When that's on the back of everything else that's been done over the course of this past year, I mean, if you think about it, when they, you know, decided to go out and run the election cycle they did during the midterms in 2010, they ran on jobs and the creation of jobs. And yet you look at those states that elected those Republican governors and that elected those state House representatives and senators and even sent those to Washington, you know, you would be far-pressed to find a Congress, you know, on the state or national level that has introduced one bill related to job creation. But you will find a host of bills that have been introduced around abortion, around reproduction rights, around contraception, redefining personhood. You would find a host of bills around that. So whether they want to call an attack on women or, you know, a war on women, I really don't care what they call it. They don't have to call it anything because their actions are speaking volumes to what their words are saying. If they cared remotely about the plight of women, then some of the things that they do, they would not be doing. So, you know, it's really semantics for me as to what they want to call it. I have yet to see one bill. And then you have in the state of Wisconsin, when you're dealing with Governor Walker, you know, they've lost the most jobs in any state during this time period. And yet he ran on such a pro-this and pro-that and anti-union and cutting teachers' jobs and cutting firefighter jobs and all of those things and yet subsidizing, you know, oil companies and all sorts of things of that nature. So they can call it what they want, but at the end of the day, their actions are speaking volumes to how they really feel about the health care of women mentally and physically.
You know, I want to take a look at Dave Helfert, a professor of political communication at Johns Hopkins University, article that he wrote, and it's entitled, From the Front Lines of the War on Women. He writes, there is a determined and well-coordinated war on women, and the most unassailable evidence is the facts. Now, Jimmy, he speaks to what you were saying. He says, data from the Guttmacher Institute, a research, policy analysis, and public education organization, reveals that in just the first 3 months of this year, 2012, legislators in 45 state capitals have already introduced 944 provisions to limit women's reproductive health and rights. In those 45 states, 75 measures restricting abortion rights directly or indirectly have been approved by at least one legislative chamber, and 9 have been approved by both and signed into law. In the past 2 years, 19 states have introduced bills modeled on Nebraska's law that bans abortion 20 weeks after fertilization and provides an exception only to save the woman's life or when there is a serious risk of substantial and irreversible physical impairment of a major bodily function. One of those states, Arizona, declares by law that pregnancy begins up to 2 weeks before conception, from the first day of the last menstrual period of the pregnant woman. So in Arizona, at least life can be begun even before an egg is fertilized. A measure approved by Oklahoma State Senate redefines person in the public health code as all unborn children or offspring of human being from the moment of conception until birth. The Mississippi House passed a bill requiring women seeking abortion to have an examination to determine if a fetal heartbeat is present. So far this year, legislators in Alabama, Alaska, Idaho, Iowa, Kentucky, Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island have introduced provisions to require women to undergo an ultrasound prior to an abortion. Based on the principle that the most effective way to reduce teen pregnancy and abortion is through ignorance, numerous bills forbid anything but abstinence education. In Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker just signed legislation repealing the state's comprehensive sex education law. Several states have passed bills to severely restrict a woman's access to contraception through her medical insurance plan by allowing contraceptives not to be covered if the employer or organization has more objections. Such a bill was considered on the floor of the U.S. Senate, and Republicans tried to argue that it was a matter of freedom of religion. 944 bills in the first 3 months of the year, this year alone. 916 such bills introduced and considered in 2011, and hundreds in 2010, but no jobs bills.
Mm-hmm.
Never before on any matter has there been such a legislative offensive, such a coordinated drive to overrule the law of land and force everyone to adhere to one set of religious beliefs. Clearly, the Republican political agenda at the state level is dominated by the far right, whose top priorities have nothing at all to do with the economy or jobs. So as Jima was saying, I don't care what you call it. You can call it, you know, whatever. But the fact remains that the legislation after legislation has been about women's reproductive rights. It has been about women and their bodies, not about the economy and jobs. So I pose the question to you. Is there a war on women in this country? 323-580-5712 is the number to call. 323-580-57 is the number to call. Press 1 to talk and 2 to listen. We're going to go to the phone lines. Caller, last 4-6547. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Give us your name and where you're calling from.
Yes, this is Catherine from Dallas, Texas.
Hey,
and I
Catherine, how are we doing?
I'm doing fine, sir. I'm enjoying listening to your show. It's very informative, and I appreciate y'all bringing all these events, information out to people in this country. What I would like to share with you today is there is a website for people to go on to that has children that's in the ages of ninth grade through the 12th grade in high school. If they're in any athletics, they can go to www.bigtxsports.org. And what this does is giving out scholarships to students that's interested in going to college, that's in academics, any form of academics.
All athletics. Right, that's wonderful. Give us the address one more time.
Yes, it is www.bigtxsports.org. And this is for any students that's interested in going to college and they're needing a scholarship and they're in any form of athletics.
Thank you
from
so
the
much
to the
for
12th
that.
Grade. Yes. Okay.
All right, Sister Cook. Let's talk about the legislation. Do you think that this clearly defines the Republican Party as the opposing force to women for this upcoming election?
Well, I think so, because they haven't done anything contrary to the things that's being highly identified. And I think the sad part about it is that's not to say that, you know, everybody in the Republican Party feels the way that those that are in positions of leadership authority and that those who have been elected feel. So let me put that out there as a disclaimer. But for those that are in the position of authority and leadership, those that have been elected, this has been the line in the sand that they have drawn. Nobody drew this line for them. They drew this line. They created this firestorm. And I think it goes back to the whole thing around the birth control and contraception and how they wanted to make that a big old deal. When reality, I don't think they realize how many people use contraception for non-sexual reasons. You know, there's a lot of people that use contraception that doesn't have anything to do with sex. It has to do with health issues. And so that just showed their ignorance around the use of something as only being able to be used for one thing. It's like you have a sponge and you just use the sponge on the spongy side, but you also have the brittle side on the other side. Well, if you never use it for that, then you're just going to be scraping, using, just wasting your energy on the sponge side. Well, you can flip it over. Where there's more uses out of birth control pills contraception than just prevention of a childbirth or getting pregnant. So
okay,
they failed to do their due diligence on that, and that's what starts the whole thing.
Here's my problem. The Republican Party is pretty smart. I mean, at the least, they're wordsmiths. I mean, they can spin any subject any way they want to, but it doesn't seem to me that they can get away from this particular topic. Now, mind you, that there has been discussion after discussion about this particular topic, and they keep reintroducing it. Okay, nobody was talking about contraception. Nobody was talking about women's health again, but here they are re-injecting this with now the student loan thing, right? Talking about, let's take away the mammograms, screening, let's take away cancer screening, let's take away all of these issues associated with women's health, and then let's take that money and let's inject it in part of student loans. Every opportunity that they have to avoid this conversation, they bring it back up. So what is going on with them? Or should I say, it must not be a real issue for women. Because, obviously they keep bringing it up, and they're not getting any repercussions behind it.
Who's not getting any repercussions behind it?
The Republican Party. They still in power.
I think we wait to see what happens in November as to whether or not there's repercussions behind it. I think you check out to see what happens in Wisconsin with the recall of Scott Walker, who just reauthorized the bill or would sign the law that took away equal pay for equal work for women, and find out if that's going to have an impact on people that go out and vote for him. So I think it's too soon to determine whether or not it's going to have an impact, because we haven't had a major election yet. But I tell you, in my opinion, this is just the world according to Jima, watching what happens in Wisconsin with Scott Walker is major. It is major. And just like, you know, people didn't think that they were going to get enough signatures to even have the recall, those people have stood up, those that are caring and concerned about what's happening. And I guarantee you that when women began to realize and understand what equal pay for equal work really means to them, it has nothing to do with two people doing two different things. It's two people doing the exact same thing, one male, one female, and the male getting paid a whole lot more money. Now, what you could say back in the day was that was because the man was the breadwinner, okay? But that's not the case anymore. So the law needs to be adjusted to fit the times in which we live in. And until that happens, then, there will be an outcry. And so because there hasn't been a major election yet, and I really think the Republicans think we're not paying attention. That's what they're hoping anyway. Let me say that. I think they're hoping that we're not paying attention, because we sometimes get all riled up and then we go away. You know, we have all this firepower for about 2.5 seconds, and then if nothing changes, then we're done with it. And so I think that's what they're thinking is going to happen. But I think this time, because they've offended so many people, it's not just a group of people. You know, it's not just you offended black people, oh, they'll get over it. You've offended women of every race, of every socioeconomic status, just across the board. It doesn't matter, because you've made such a blanket statement about my health care that I don't think you should have the right to make. And it's so across the board, and they try to attach everything back to abortion when that's the least of it all. But when you are denying funds for me to go and check to see if I have breast cancer, which we know is on the rise in certain groups of people, when you're cutting funds for me to go and have my pap smear done to check to make sure that everything I have is in working order, and see, that's what increases health care costs, because we don't find out stuff in enough time, and then by the time we find out about it, the preventive stuff, it's too late. So now you're in the intervention and the treatment phase, and that's three times as much as it was on the preventive side. So they don't, you know, for them to be so fiscally responsible, they miss that part. They miss the part about prevention. These exams are to prevent diseases, which then would help lower health costs, because you wouldn't have so many people getting sick. It seems real simple to me. I don't know. Maybe I'm just having a simple moment today, but they miss that. And because they missed that, they've created this whole big thing, and I think it will have an impact on them as they go down the road. They're going to have to make some shifts, just like he had to make a shift on the whole student loan thing. Boehner is going to have to make some more shifts before this is all said and done. Or he's right when he made his first statement that they'll lose the House come election time, because they will.
I definitely have to agree with you on that.
You got to remember, you know, what's the saying, hell's half no fury than a woman scorned? This is what they're dealing with right now. This is what they're dealing with right now.
Okay, I want to shift now to the question I posed at the top of the show about George Zimmerman.
Oh, my.
Last week, you know, I tried to use a clinical term, perjury, right? And I kind of just stumbled all over the board, perjury, right? And in fact, I stumbled on the word because I wanted to not even use the clinical term. I wanted to say he was, in fact, lying.
Right. Downright.
Because
right.
he
mm-hmm.
said on the stand that, of course, he thought Trayvon Martin was just a little younger than he was.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact,
mm-hmm.
on the 911 call that everybody in the world heard him say, he's in his late teens. So right there, he was lying on the stage. And, of course, I was livid. Now it turns out that his family said they were destitute, without money. They said they didn't have anything, so which made the judge give a bond that was really, really reasonable for someone that didn't have any money. But it turns out, again, he was lying. Don't take my word for it. I want you to hear this for yourself. Listen to what his attorney had to come back to the judge and admit to. Take a listen, and then I want you to respond.
There has been some information that I think the court needs to be made aware of, so I'd like to do that. It's not set for hearing, but it's more just an information to the court. You may want to then react to it. We were before you last Friday on a bond hearing. There was testimony elicited from family members concerning their financial standing. They said they didn't have very much. They didn't have very many savings. At that point, I had a passing familiarity with two websites that had some money in them, one about $700 administered by some friend, actually a witness that we now know of, but I don't know him. Another one with about $2,000 in it, either administered by that same person or somebody else, but not by my client. There was a website produced by my client called therealgeorgezimmerman.com with a request for donations on it. That's been in about a month or 6 weeks. I don't know the particulars because all that information is still flowing into me. Coincidentally, and after the hearing, when I realized that there were other false websites suggesting that they were Mr. Zimmerman and false Twitter accounts, and quite honestly, very dangerous false Twitter accounts, I made the very quick decision he will have no more internet presence whatsoever. All his websites are down, whatever he had, Twitter, Facebook, everything, so that he has no existence on the web except that which is administered through my office. In that conversation, and once I talked to Mr. Zimmerman about that without going too much into the detail, he then disclosed to me or asked me what he should do with what's known as the PayPal accounts or the money that came through that website. We talked about it. I said, for right now, anything you have is going to go into a separate trust account in my office. We'll figure it out later, but I'm not going to touch it, and we'll see. I then realized, and in the discussion as he was setting it up to send it to me, that there was about $204,000 that was contributed in the past 30 to 45 days from the public into that account. At the time that he was before you, there was about $150,000 or so, still getting the precise amount, available for whatever purposes. That was not disclosed to you by the family members. Of course, my client didn't testify as to that, but he was certainly here for the testimony. I think that you needed to be aware of that and certainly should be aware of it today. I'm not going to argue. My understanding is that they didn't believe that was fully available to them, but it was there. It is no longer there, obviously. It is now every amount of money that was residual is either already in a separate trust account under only my control, And there's still some money coming from actually PayPal organizations just in transit. It is not available to him. I have to figure out in some way how it's to be administered. That's a duty that I'll take on, but I do think that you need to be aware that there was, actually is, $150,000 available to the family. I will tell you that it's not leaving my trust account for any purposes unless I have more time and help to figure it out. But you need to be aware that as of Friday, at least that money was out there.
I would submit that that is a change in circumstance regarding the bond, and I would ask the court to address it appropriately, and that the family members represented that they had no money when, in truth, they really did. So I don't know if they did that intentionally or what, but so I would submit that there's a change in circumstance regarding bond, and I would consider ask the court to consider possibly raising the bond.
Before I can make a decision concerning this, I need to see who had control over that account. I may not have jurisdiction to tell anybody to do anything, or else I may. So to that extent, I would request, Mr. O'Meara, if you're able to do so, to find out the genesis of the account, find out how this account came to come into existence, who's in charge of the account, the date of the payments that were made to the account, and who has authority on the PayPal account, who that person was. And if you can find that out and give that to the state, I think that will go a long way toward the state. I'm going to hold your motion in abeyance until we find out what's going on. Like I said, I may have authority. I may not have authority. I don't know. Before I start ordering large sums of money to be deposited or changed or affected, I need to find out who actually had authority and if this was a nominee account, whatever.
Those people who have donated to Mrs. Zimmerman's fund, I will tell you, are going to feel that they're in that end of the spectrum that I talked to you about, that should it be disclosed that they are actively supporting Mr. Zimmerman, that they will be exposed to ridicule, danger, harassment, et cetera. So it is going to be transparent, but it is going to be done in a way that protects those individuals who have found it in their hearts to assist Mrs. Zimmerman in this time of need.
Wow. This is crazy to me. I don't understand how, A, the judge allowed this to happen. Because, I mean, obviously, if you know enough about the money and you know enough about the account, you can answer those questions that the judge has asked right then. He could have, and then the prosecution, Lord bless his soul, because that's all I can say right now, that he should have done a better job of asking the judge the questions about who was on the count. I mean, the attorney can't get account to my. He can't get him account. He can't get access to my account. I mean, there's no way for him to get access to my account. I'm not going to allow him to just go up and get my account. So the account he has access to, i.e., Mr. O'Meara, the Zimmerman's attorney, it has to be associated with his client. Period. So I don't know how the judge, you know, thinks that he could go around and just saying that I don't know who money this is and I don't know. There's a record of it. I have a PayPal account. I understand there's a process in place that when the money is is paid out, it takes a few days for it to be available in your account. Once it's available, it's yours. So if he had $150,000 available to him during the trial, somebody was lying. And I don't understand why the judge or the prosecution didn't do something about it right then. Jim, am I just over the top on this issue?
No, you're not over the top. And I think the prosecution did all that it could do in terms of asking for higher bail or for bail to be revoked or whatever. The judge, I think, had a lot more power to do something and chose to err on the side of, I don't know, I'm not even going to say caution, because it was a blatant lie. The family lied, and I believe they were sworn in. So whether or not George Zimmerman made any statements about the account, the family knew that money was there, and they sat there over the phone in disguise, hiding and whatever else, making, you know, these pleas like we don't have any money. I bet the wife knew the money was there. So the fact that, you know, they basically just outright lied and lied under oath because, as I stated, they were sworn in, something should be done to them for lying. They knew that money was there, and they knew they had access to it. And even if you don't have access, as you just stated, you know how much you have. You know how much is going to be available. You know when somebody's paid something or not. So,
some in the milk ain't
that,
clean about this case. I said that last week. I've been saying it. Some in the milk ain't clean about this case.
And
you
the
know,
judge isn't making it any easier for us to think that he's dead,
I'm
that
telling
this is going to be, yeah, I'm with you.
And so, I mean, you know, every week is something else. Every week, you know, is something else. And so they continue to muddy the water. They continue, in my opinion, to actually, you know, pour salt on our criminal justice system. Now, granted, a lot of us already believe it is not, you know, these type of cases don't fall in our favor anyway.
Mm-hmm.
This just makes it worse.
Right.
I just don't understand how he could go on and just allow this to happen. And then, again, George Zimmerman is a free man right now, kicking up, watching the Lakers play right now, watching the playoffs right now, kicking up, drinking margaritas. Because we already know, you know, if he's having that kind of fun, you can't test the alcohol the next day. So he could be having all kind of fun right now, just kicking back, you know, free. And we know he killed Trayvon. There's no question in my mind that he did it. Nobody's mind.
Right. Well, there's no question in his mind. He knows.
And all of these credibility issues keep coming up week in and week out. So, based on the evidence, based on all the things that happened, you know, and I posed this question last week. You know, is this going to be another OJ case? Is he going to get out? Is he going to get away with murder? What do you think?
I hope not. I'm just still hoping that he doesn't. I'm hoping that, you know, that this judge looks at the facts of the case.
The facts are already, I mean, he has the facts. He ain't do nothing with them.
I know. I'm just hoping, though, that this was just one where he was just trying not to, because, if he was to do that, then he would have had to bring the family back in and hold them, you know, I don't know, contempt or accountable for lying under oath, which I think is against the law.
Then it
comes down to whether or not, you know, they could, you know, once again, they could lie all over again and say they didn't know or they didn't have nothing to do with that account or, you know, they could lie all over again. But I guarantee you that one of those people that sat up there last Friday and made those statements on how indigent they were and how they was going to have to mortgage their house and they couldn't do this, I guarantee you one of them knew that they were sitting on $150,000 somewhere, I guarantee you. And so for that I say, well, okay, then his daily expenses, wherever they got him hemmed up at, he should pay for that out of that money. If you don't want to raise his bond, then he shouldn't be able, the taxpayers of Florida shouldn't be having to pay for him to be in a hotel somewhere or wherever he is.
Well, I can tell you what I think the attorney is saying. He said, hey, you got $200,000, you're going to pay me. I'm putting
without
it in my
doubt trust.
I'm putting
without
it in my
doubt.
So now he knows where the money is because it's in his trust. So, you know, I think for Zimmerman to say he didn't have any money and he wasn't going to pay the attorney can say, well, wait a minute. Now, I thought you didn't have any money, but now I do know you got some money. You can pay. So nobody should be talking now about, you know, the state paying for his defense. He can pay for his defense.
Right. Because the attorney has already stated that the defense is going to run up $2 million. He already made that statement.
Well, $200,000 is a nice down payment.
I agree with that. I agree with that wholeheartedly.
This is a sick case altogether.
And
every
then you
week
go, you look, right, and you look at the fact that we're looking at it, and then 20 years ago, you know, we was dealing with the whole fallout from Rodney King. You know, you're wondering, you know, will those same sorts of feelings stir up themselves again in the event that this thing actually goes to trial and it doesn't come out the way we all think it should? Because, you know, we've seen this picture before. It's just different characters. You know, we've seen this movie already. We've seen it. And, you know, although we've seen it, we're watching it in anticipation, hoping that because there's new players in the game that we'll have a different outcome. And unfortunately, only time will tell.
Well, I'm predicting another OJ situation. I think the level of intensity will be the same. I think what people will be waiting by the television sets, Twitter accounts, Facebook, with bated breath for the verdict. And even if it goes to a plea, people are going to be really, talking about this situation for many, many, many years to come. And I guarantee you, you know, this will be in some of our legal institution as a part of study when it comes to especially these type of laws and the defense that was put up and the prosecution, their job. I mean, the prosecution has really disappointed me. Every time they get up, it seems like they're unprepared. Every mm-hmm. single time. That could just be me, but I'm telling you, it doesn't look like they're doing a good job right now.
Yeah, it seems like they're not prepared for the which is interesting because the special prosecutor, she seemed real prepared in her remarks and how she spoke and the different things she was saying. But yet, when you hear the people that are actually trying the case, they don't seem to have her same level of competency, in my opinion.
323-580-5712 is the number to dial. 323-580-5712 is the number to dial. Press 1 to talk and 2 to listen. When you think about the actual office that, you know, the police department, you know, that whole structure right there was kind of can be in question. Isn't the prosecution extension of that structure?
Right. I mean, well, you go back to the fact that it was the detective on duty that wanted to press charges, but it was the prosecutor's office that said no because wherever they had got word from. So you know, you look at that, and then for the police chief to come out and say, you know, we have no evidence to even arrest him, you know, it's like, seriously, you have no evidence? Well, you probably don't, because it's been trampled all over. And you didn't collect anything when it was fresh. So he probably wasn't lying when he said we don't have enough evidence because they had gotten rid of all of it. So
I want to
be able to be gathered.
I want to pull on that thread for a second. Now, the prosecution is really an extension of this Stanford Police Department. And so if, in fact, that when Zimmerman came into the police department and then they said, is there enough to charge him with, the prosecution drove 50 miles to say, nope, he's innocent. Shouldn't that be a question in our minds whether he's the right person for the job? Or that office?
Well, I don't think it's the same prosecutor. I don't think it's
the same office and leadership.
Right, I agree. I agree. I'm thinking they brought in some special people from another. I'm just hoping here. I don't know, but I don't think the city of Sanford's prosecution department are the ones that are in charge of trying this case. I could be wrong, so I'll do some research on that. But either way, your point is well taken in terms of the fact that this is part. I mean, they're walking hand in hand here.
Same people that let him go the first time, same department, whether it's
exactly.
The same group or not, the same leadership structure is in place because
right.
whoever he
I
got called him. When I get called in on the weekends of work, it ain't my subordinates that call me. It's my superiors that call me and say, hey, I need you to come in. And so when they come and I log in and do what I have to do, it's because my superiors have said, hey, we need your help, right?
Right.
And so I'm sure a similar situation had to happen here, where they called him in and said, hey, you know, we need you to go in and check out the situation. Make sure you let him off. You know, I know his daddy, you know, whatever situation. I don't know what happened, but I'm just saying, hypothetically, you know, I know his pops, you know, I'm sure whatever happened, he killed a black dude, but, you know, we don't want him to, you know, well, I don't know what happened. But I'm saying, you know, that's the call he could have got. And now that same line of people is now questioning him, you know, on the case. I wonder why they look so incompetent. That's my question.
Right, right. I agree with you. There does appear that there's some, you know, some things about this that's not real clear. Maybe there's a strategy that I'm not aware of, that you know, they're planning this a certain way for, you know, a long-term effect. But I know right now is they're not looking very competent, and they're looking as though, and neither is the judge, though. I'm not pleased with the judge either. So,
leadership structure.
Yeah, this judge doesn't seem to kind of know what his authority is. I mean, I would have said, give me the money and then find out later I got to get the money back. I mean, you know, I'm going to put myself in that position of making that kind of tough decision. He's sitting on the bench wavering, talking about, oh, well, I don't want to take somebody's money. Seriously? You know, I mean, I couldn't believe what I was hearing out of his mouth. So this is, I don't know. I just hope it ends peacefully. That's all I can hope for at this juncture.
Well, well, well. We'll see about that, won't we? And let's shift now to entertainment news.
Yes.
Specifically, I want to talk about two things. I want to talk a little bit about the Steve Harvey's movie. And I want to talk about this hot new show, Scandal. This show was the bomb. I had no idea
really?
It was going to be that good. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about Steve Harvey's show. So, first of all, let me give my hat off to Steve Harvey for a great movie. And I say it's a great movie because we haven't had a lot of bromance movies on the scene in a long time. What I mean by bromance, I'm talking about, you know, the movies back in the day, like what are some of those good movies that we used to go to? So all those good black movies that they had where they were dating and stuff like that.
Okay, we can talk about The Best Man,
Wood. Yeah.
You can talk about Love and Basketball. You can talk about Love Jones.
Yeah. And this to me reaches that same level of a classic, if you will. In that level, so in my opinion, the movie was outstanding on that particular instance. But on an additional note, I like the fact that the characters that he portrayed, even in the book, it seems like to me that, you know, people always try to make an association with the characters, right? And I'm not going to give the movie away. I'm not going to tell you what the characters are, but I will say that the movie was outstanding. I was cracking up the entire time. It's a must go see. And not to mention, it was one of the top movies of the last couple of weeks. So
it opened last weekend number one, and I think it did it again today, this weekend. If my Twitter feed is correct, I think it topped box office numbers again this week.
So what do you think about the movie?
It was good. I thought it was good. I thought the characters were good. I thought the pairings of the people were good. I think it will be one of those movies. You know, I'm one of those people. If The Best Man comes on TV, I'm watching it like I've never seen it before. Two Can Play That Game comes on TV, I'm watching it like I've never seen it before. So I'm thinking this would become one of those as well, that, you know, over time you will continue to sit back and watch this movie because it just, you know, it has so much of a message. And even, you know, Why Did I Get Married? Whenever that comes on, I sit back and I watch that as well. So I think this is one of the ones that'll stick around for a while. It has some good music in it as well. And I think everybody's character played their part, and they played their part well. And Kevin Hart, I mean, hats off to him. I don't even know what to say about Kevin Hart. He was just phenomenal to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, it, for me, and I'm gonna just be straight up and honest. When Steve Harvey talked about, you know, writing the book about relationships, my first thought was, who is he to tell me, you know, about relationships? What he's giving me, what he was giving me at the time, was that this is just a movie about his opinion about relationships, right? Because you cannot impose your view, your culture, your relationships on me and my view and my culture and my relationships. But it was obvious to me by watching the book, and by watching the movie, and I haven't read the book, but the principles of the movie, it seems like they were researched. There was a lot of things that were fact-based and statistical analysis that was done that talked about certain areas. So I have to give, again, a lot of credibility to the closeness of the factual evidence that was portrayed in the book about things and how, because I was able to identify with a lot of the different situations. Wasn't able to identify with one of the characters per se, but a lot of the situations that were in the movie I thought were just hilarious, and I was able to identify either through me or through a friend of mine that I knew that went through something similar. So again, it was a great movie. My hats off to him.
I agree.
I want to shift to Scandal now. Again, I was hearing a lot about Scandal, you know, and it was mostly from women, right? I mean, okay, because, you know, whatever, you know, women like certain movies. It was cool. I mean, you know, to be honest, right? I mean, you know, I'm like, ah, it's another chick flick. So I was like, yeah, whatever. So I sat down, and like I do on most movies, my first time I end up doing a marathon. So I can watch two or three of the episodes together to kind of get caught up to see if it, if there's some continuity between episode to episode, if there is something, a storyline that resonates with me, and then there are some, you know, some good, you know, some good action in the movie periodically, right? This show had them all. And, of course, now what was interesting about this show that I haven't seen in a long time is really, really fast paced, right? You cannot be sitting down and miss a second or two and consider yourself to be caught up, because if you miss a second, you can be lost for like the next 5 minutes. So it's a very fast paced, intellectually stimulating and socially interesting show. So, Jim, what did you get from watching Scandal?
Well, I think for me, I've always loved Kerry Washington. So anytime she's in something, I try my best to go and see it or watch it, because I just like her. She's just such a wholesome type of actress, and she really puts her all into it. So when I saw that it was that she was the one that was going to be playing the person whose story this is loosely, you know, kind of connected to, I was like, okay, I got to watch this. And so I'm like you, the pace of it, the storyline that has the main storyline that seems to just going to weave us through the whole season, and then these other, you know, storylines that's on the side that come in every week, but there's the one main thing that's going on. And I just find it to be fascinating that you know, on the scale of the lady whom Kerry Washington plays, her character in the movie is Julia Pope, but the person's real name I can't think of right now, it escapes me. I'm going to say it's Judy somebody, but I don't know. But they were on the front of Essence magazine cover for the March issue of Essence. So if you haven't gotten it, or go online and look at it. But anyway, so based on, you know, some of the things that this person is known to have had her hand in terms of fixing things and getting major PR issues that she's been able to turn from a negative into a positive. So I think just, you know, seeing how fast pace is going, and it's a 1-hour show on a Thursday night, and you are just, as you stated, you're glued, you can't breathe until it's a commercial, you know, and that's what I like about it. You know, I haven't had that feeling about a show since 24. 24 gave you that you were just on a high, you were just going and going, and you was like, couldn't breathe for the first 15 minutes of the show because you weren't sure what was going to happen. And that's how I feel about Scandal. I'm sitting down, I'm ready, because I know somebody's going to do something that is going to be like, what? And then bam. So I just love it. And if you haven't seen it, you can watch it online. If whatever your channel, your cable provider, they have it on demand on ABC. It is an excellent show.
And this should also, and let's be honest, dispel the notion that you cannot have an African-American lead a show on doing a major night, date, and time, right? Because she is really, you know, over the top when it comes to this role. And so she's going to really pave the way for having African-American female and male actors play leading roles, just like the president did in 24, but for her to come in and now play this leading role in a major network on a major time slot is amazing. And so I think this is great on so many different levels. And the fact that the research was done not too long ago about the amount of African-American women that are watching TV in this time, it's about time they're catering to that particular demographic.
Right, and I think, you know, the point that you make is well taken in terms of that this is a non-comedy. You know, we're not often seen to be able to play in, you know, a series that is more serious. But, you know, they'll put us in a comedic role in a second. But for her to be the lead in a drama, basically, on prime time is awesome, and I'm just excited about it. I'm excited. So I think that this is going to go far. I think if people get out and really start figuring out what it's all about and get caught up as you did, O ye who doubt, those of us that know, you'll find that you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Absolutely. And then I guess I got to admit, the name kind of threw me too. You know, when I saw Scandal, I'm thinking another trashy type movie, but it's far from that. I mean, it is really a good watch. You will see the rationale for the naming because it's a provocative title, but you'll also see all the things that you would normally see in a good TV action field drama show. I mean, it's really that good. Okay, so finally, we only have a few more minutes remaining before the end of the show, and I want to give you an opportunity, Jima, to talk about your recent visit down to this conference that you attended last week. So, will you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I attended the Annie Casey Foundation's annual conference for Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative. And some of the things that, and it was in Houston for a couple of days last week, left out on Tuesday and got back on Thursday, excuse me. And a couple of the main topics that were discussed was one of the highlights for me was a panel that was there of parents of children who are incarcerated for a variety of reasons. And for me, it doesn't really matter why they're incarcerated, but I think where we do a disservice of those of us that are on the administrative end or those of us that work in juvenile justice is that we paint all parents with a broad stroke. And that stroke is that, you know, they've done something wrong or their child wouldn't be in trouble. And so we tend to pigeonhole them and treat them so bad. And we have kids in places. One parent spoke of the fact that her child was placed 5 hours away from where they live and that you have to go through this process of submitting the day and time you want to come to visit 2 weeks or ten days in advance of when you want to show up. And then they'll let you know if you can come or not in 5 days. And so by the time they get back with you, you're not even sure if you can go, you know, or if you'll still be able to go due to, you know, mitigating circumstances in your life. And so this particular day, she was able to go. They said, yes, you can come. She made all the plans. She got up at 3:00 in the morning, left home at 4:00 because as I stayed a 5.5-hour drive to where her son was. She gets there, and she's about 15 minutes late. She had a flat tire on the way. And so and they denied her visit because she was 15 minutes late. And these are the things, you know, that's just one story of many. After a person has gotten up and made the effort to be somewhere, and because of something that was not her fault, she is denied a visit with her son. And then she's taken through not only just a metal detector, but then they, you know, they pat search her as well as stick their hand under her shirt to ensure that she's not bringing in anything into the institution. And so you hear the stories of the parents and you're like, when did we become this nation that this is how we treat people? And then when you look at the conditions, and I've worked in several states in a consulting role, and I've looked at conditions of how they treat their children in terms of, the, you know, they live in cells that may or may not have a mattress on the bed and may or may not have working plumbing that's filled with rodents and roaches and things of that nature. And when it's cold, there's such a space between the door and the floor that a draft comes in. And so you have all, you know, sorts of elements coming into the cell. And this is where they are. And so you have a segment of our population that says, you know, we have to be tough on crime. And so because, you know, tough on crime means doesn't mean that we treat people inhumanely. And for somewhere along the line, that's where we've become. And so what this conference does is it brings together like-minded people who want to change the conditions. Not only do we want to change the conditions, we want to make sure that kids don't end up in these places. So, you know, it's truly about trying to reach them before they get into trouble. Unfortunately, all the money is in after they get in trouble. And we've had that conversation before. The Casey Foundation has done a magnificent job in incorporating places around the country where they're calling it their JDAI initiative. And by that, you have counties in each state that has taken up said, okay, we want to do something different with our numbers. We don't want to keep locking up black children and brown children and Native Americans and because those are the three groups that get locked up the most. You know, how can we address that? And so, you know, counties now are doing different things. And I have to say, for all the times I've gone to this conference, this was the first time I would say over half of the people in attendance were there for the first time. And that's significant because what that means is that the Casey Foundation is expanding. And so, you know, as it expands, then how do we sustain the growth that we're seeing? And so there's so many things we talked about in the breakout sessions around not only do we need to address that part of it, but when we're, you know, who's going to address the education of people coming into the field after they get that degree in criminal justice or social work or education even sometimes, then they come out and they come to work and they have this jaded view of what it is you're supposed to do with kids that are incarcerated. And so, you know, when will we begin to address that part of the end? And so that's called deep end treatment. And so it was just an excellent conference. I met a lot of people there from the state of Texas as well as across the country. And it's always good to be in the room with people that get what you think in terms of how do we treat our kids once they've gotten in trouble. And tough on crime doesn't mean that we have to treat them inhumane and that the conditions have to be inhumane. And consequence doesn't always mean punishment. Punishment doesn't mean that you have to be treated, you know, unjustly or unfairly. And so, you know, I know the person is going to say, you know, well, you know, that kid killed my child and I want them to go away. That's fine that they have to go away, but they shouldn't have to go away to a place that's inhumane, that won't treat them like they're human. And so if we can get away from mistreating people just because they've done something wrong and still treat them with some dignity and some respect, excuse me, you'll have a better chance of them being adding something to society when they get out as opposed to taking everything away. So,
all right. Any final comments?
We are nearing a part here in Dallas County in Texas where we're going to start doing some voting, and there's some early voting that kicks off tomorrow and I believe goes through May 12th. So I say get out, make sure everything is in order in terms of your voter registration. I did get my voter registration card in at the beginning of this week, so that's an awesome thing. But just get out there and exercise your right to vote. So many things and so many people lost their lives fighting for this, and it would do us a great injustice to just allow just to sit back and not vote in these local elections, because this is what hits you first is your local elections, because these are the people that have a direct impact on your school system, that, you know, in terms of education, in terms of what gets funded and what don't get funded. These judges that are on the benches, they're voted in. And so make sure you know who you're voting for and what they stand for, so that at the end of the day, you're voting for your interest and not against your interest.
Well, that's our show for today. I would like to thank all the listeners for tuning in. And, of course, a special thanks to my co-host, the wonderful, the magnificent Jima Hill Cook. Now, don't forget to follow her on Twitter, and that's at AskJima. That's AskJema. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or website, go to our website at tailormade101.com. Remember, it is written, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Now, don't forget to bookmark our website, and that's at tailormadetalkradio.blogspot.com. That's TAILORMADE talk radio, all one word, .blogspot.com. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer in Sweet Dreams. Take us away, Joyce.